Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Steve Ramirez, and he'll be answering your questions on casting homeward. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the internet. If you'd like to ask Steve a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill out the form on the right side of our homepage, and we'll let you know when the next live show will be. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website about 48 hours after the show ends. You can also find it on any of the podcast sites like Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, wherever you listen to your podcasts. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website or any of the podcast platforms at your convenience and listen to the recording at any time. If you're out and about on Facebook, Instagram, or X, we'd sure appreciate it if you'd share our podcast. And when you do, use that hashtag AskAboutFlyFishing and hashtag FlyFishing. In fact, if you have a moment, do it while you're listening to the show. That would be wonderful. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted. It's the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. When we return, we'll be talking with Steve Ramirez about casting homeward. Enrico Puglisi flies pride themselves in creating unique and one-of-a-kind flies and fly tying material. Enrico has been experimenting with durable synthetic and natural materials to create flies that catch fish for more than 30 years. His innovative products, including brushes, fibers, and components, have made a major impact on the direction of saltwater fly fishing, and his methods and materials are respected worldwide. Whether you want your flies hand-tied for you or you'd like to tie your own, be sure to visit Enrico Puglisi Flies and browse through their online catalog. Visit epflies.com and do a little shopping today. Again, that's epflies.com. Before we introduce Steve, I'd like to let you know about the great prizes we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away 1-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a 1-year membership to Trout Unlimited. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at AskAboutFlyFishing.com. Look for the link under Steve's section that says Register for a Free Drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Steve's latest book, Casting Homeward, courtesy of Lions Press. And here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something that Steve and I have talked about during the show, and just submit your answer along with your name and location using that text box on the homepage. So it's the same text box that you use to ask questions during the show. So listen closely, take notes, use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll be the proud owner of Steve's latest book, Casting Homeward. Our guest tonight is Steve Ramirez. Steve is an outdoor and conservation author who lives and writes in the Texas Hill Country. Steve's first book, Casting Forward, Fishing Tales from the Texas Hill Country, has received critical acclaim and is in its third hardcover printing. His work has appeared in various journals, including Fly Fisherman Magazine, Trout Magazine, The Fly Fish Journal, American Angler, Hallowed Waters Journal, Tail Magazine, Texas Sporting Journal, Explore Magazine, Under Wild Skies, Cutthroat Journal of the Arts, the Houston Literary Review, and many more. Steve serves as the ambassador for Texas for the American Museum of Fly Fishing. He's a life member of Trout Unlimited and is a contributing member of the Nature Conservancy, Audubon, and Native Fish Coalition. As a certified master naturalist, Steve is passionately involved in promoting the restoration and conservation of the watersheds, rivers, canyons, forests, deserts, wetlands, grasslands, and shorelines of North America and beyond. He's an avid hiker and world adventure traveler who has explored 4 continents, but who always seems to return home to the spring-fed hill country streams of Texas. Steve lives in Elk Comfort, Texas. Steve, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, thank you. It's so great to be back. Thank you for inviting me. That was sure, a lot sure. to say about me. I have to get you a shorter bio.
Shorter? It's good for the search engines up on the website. So,
great.
Yeah, no, that's... well, you know, you've done a lot of writing in your time in the journals and so forth, so a lot to cover there. But, yeah, this is the third time we've had you on the show. First time I'm looking at show on September 21st, 2022. We talked about Casting Forward, Onward, and Seaward, your first three books. And then we talked specifically about Casting Seaward in June of 2023. So folks, you can find both those shows on our archive. If you just put in Steve's name, you'll find them, and enjoy those shows as well. But tonight we're going to talk with Steve about his latest book, which is Casting Homeward, and his adventures out there while he had to do his homework before he wrote this book. And I feel so sorry for him. But so you can send your condolences in and we'll pass them on to Steve. Yeah. Okay. Hard work to do the research, right? And have the experiences.
Absolutely. And if they can read the book and suffer with me vicariously.
Yeah, there you go.
Every book that I do is, you know, thousands of miles of traveling, as I say, by plane, train, automobile, boat, canoe, foot, and horseback. So, and occasionally falling down. So,
This is your fourth book in your casting series, and I got the impression that this might be the last book of the casting series.
It is. It is. It's the completion, full circle. So,
and tell us about the series.
Okay. The series was intended to be a four-book series, and each book stands alone on its own in one way, but each book also connects to the next. So the way I wrote these, the way I conceived them, is that they would act like ponds, like ripples in a pond, like you dropped a stone into a pond, and they ripple out until they hit the shore, and then they bounce back. So Casting Forward, the first book is focused here in the Texas Hill Country. And its main focus beside, for anyone who hasn't read any of my writing before, either in the books or with my column in Fly Fisherman magazine, I try to make sure that I'm taking people on an adventure with me, something they're going to enjoy and get something out of as they read and they feel they're there with me. But I'm also doing something else. I'm putting in a lot about the nature of the place. And by that, I mean everything from the ecology to the history, the geology. In all four books, I include both Euro-American and Indigenous American thought and how it relates to nature. So Casting Forward was here in the Hill Country, and its biggest focus is on the healing power of nature, because I'm a former Marine with PTSD, and it's a whole lot about how fly fishing in nature can be so healing. That book ended up in the movie Mending the Line, starring Brian Cox, which, if you haven't seen it, it's on Netflix, a beautiful film. Then the next one, I went across the United States. This four-book series is all within the United States, other than some time in the Caribbean. And I traveled across the United States with the goal of seeking out native fish in their native waters and telling that story of how they reflect what we've done to the earth and where we're trying to save it. And with all of these, I'm telling the story through the eyes of the people that live there and love those waters. So it's not just the place and the fish, it's the people. Casting Seaward, as you would guess, I decided I was going to go from Alaska all the way down the Pacific coast to California, in the Gulf of Mexico, out to the Caribbean, and then up the Florida coast all the way to Montauk, New York. And in that one, I am focused on, as you would guess, saltwater fish. But I also go after anadromous fish, such as salmon. And in Alaska, I followed salmon from the ocean all the way to the smallest tributaries in the Tungus Wilderness. And then now Casting Homeward. And as you would hear from the name, we're going homeward. It begins in Texas, it ends in Texas, and in the middle what I do is I travel from the furthest reaches of Alaska in the Bristol Bay area, and then go backwards in time, so to speak, from west to east, kind of retracing the expansion of Europeans across America through where Lewis and Clark went, through the Rocky Mountains, and working my way through the Rockies down into Texas, Oklahoma, and ending up right outside New York City in the Catskills, which many people call the birthplace of American fly fishing. So that's the four-book series right there.
Okay, great, yeah. So you explained, yeah, the themes to each book, which is wonderful. And you did a lot of writing in journals, magazines, so forth, prior to your starting this, the casting series. Had you written any books before that, or was this whole series kind of a new endeavor for you?
These are my first books that I've written. So prior to this, I wrote short and published short fiction and poetry, but also essays and stories in magazines about the outdoors, not just fishing, but also hunting. Back when I was hunting, I don't really hunt anymore, and also other outdoor adventure activities around the world. So I would write those things. But those were all in magazines and literary journals. And this is my first set of four books, which has taken about 7 years to write.
Now, was most of your writing done after you got out of the Marines? Was
that, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Other than all the journaling I did in the Marine Corps, yes. So,
yeah.
Yes. But I've been writing since, you know, people ask, well, when did you start writing? Well, the truth is I started writing since I was a kid. I was writing stories back then. It's just something I have to do. I have to write. And in the Marine Corps, I have the original journals of me at a post waiting to see if I was going to be blown up that day. So, and I have my original journals of exactly how I felt in the moment. So I've always been writing.
Will there ever be a book about your experiences in the Marine Corps?
Probably not. Probably as close as we get to that. And never say never to anything, but the truth is there's nothing special about me. It's just that I try to translate the journeys I take so that other people get something out of it. And
Okay. So, just thought I'd ask.
Well, and some of it I can't, this sounds silly, but some of it I can't write about. So my last 3 years were the top secret clearance overseas, and, you know, I don't really want to go through all that.
Yeah, I didn't, my dad was in the Air Force, like we talked about before in the show, and he was an intelligence officer, and my whole life, it's, what does your dad do? Well, I don't know. He works in an office with no windows.
Right. Right.
And I didn't really find out about some of the stuff that he worked on until he was in his 60s. So, yeah, pretty enlightening.
Yeah, I didn't tell anybody. Well, the people that I hung out with when I was with Africa Corps were mostly intelligence officers. They were either... Either civilian intelligence officers, like central intelligence officers, or they were military intelligence officers. So, I know what you speak of. When you ask your dad what he does, and he says, "I fix washing machines."
Yeah, no, I knew he didn't do that.
Right.
Yeah. Well, what initially inspired you to go on this multi-year, you know, quest of discovery, so to speak? I mean, that's my words, not yours. But, you know, with the four series and the four books in the casting series, what inspired you to get started on that?
That's a great question. The short answer is suffering. So I spent 35 years of my life in the Marine Corps and outside of the Marine Corps armed and dealing with the worst of humanity. I did everything from working in counterterrorism to undercover narcotics and weapons. And many other things where every day of my life I was armed and dealing with, we'll say, mean people. And I wasn't armed because I didn't have to, you know, I had to be. So I went from getting through that 35 years, and at the end of it, it would be pretty easy to feel completely cynical about the world. On top of that, my PTSD got worse. So Casting Forward came out of me simply trying to survive. And fly fishing and being in nature and being with my daughter as well was the way I survived. Because if you think about it, if someone is dealing with very severe PTSD and their job is to be armed every day, that's not a really good combination, if you're following me, because depression and those things come with it. So after 35 years, it was time to say, I'm done. And I started fishing and writing. It just organically happened. And people have asked me about my writing style. So I've mentioned to you, I'm just started a fifth book in a new series with Lions Press, because this series has ended and we're going in a new direction now. And people have asked me, well, how do you do that? Well, after I finish a book, I always have I have these moments of like existential angst of what am I supposed to do now? And I just know that if you go stand in a river and don't worry about it and let the universe tell me what you're supposed to do next. So these things naturally came as the more I spent thinking about what was keeping me alive. And many of us, our fathers took us out fishing and taught us about nature, and that was my case. And that's what was keeping me going, is my connection with nature and kind of the best people. So the more I got out there, the more I saw how much nature was suffering, not just me. And that's where Casting Onward came, because if you see the series, you're going to find out that the first book is very much an internal solitary journey. The next two, I am out with all these amazing people, and it's very nature-oriented and very ecologically oriented. And then Casting Homeward, we're moving back into being what's life all about, sort of a deal. So full circle. And what I love is when I hear from readers that these books have really impacted their life in a positive way. And sometimes they're saying, you found ways to say what I've been wondering. So I felt compelled to write them. I hope it's not too long-winded of an answer, but I have felt compelled that I have to write. It's like I am on a mission. It's not my doing. I'm being told this is what you'll do next. And I know it sounds very woo-woo, but it's exactly what's happening. And when I sit down to write, it just comes.
Okay. What do you hope readers will get out of your books?
A lot. First of all, I hope they enjoy them. I write for the readers, and I repeat myself purposely in my books on certain things because I want them to stick into people's head. And my social media, I often write to the people that follow me. I'll say, writers need readers. I hear about authors that don't seem to value their readers the way I do. I can't imagine it. So I'm writing for them. I want them to have fun, and I want them to enjoy it. I want them to feel like they're there with me. I want to open up worlds to them that they may not see themselves. That's the first level. Have fun. The second part is I'm hoping that they learn to love these places, because one thing I've learned everywhere I've traveled, four different continents, 21 countries, is we only save what we love, and we only love what we know. So I want to bring people, I want them to start caring about Alaska even if they've never been there. I want them to care about the Amazon even if they've never been there. And so I do that by, without beating anyone over the head, we're going down the river and we're learning together about what's going on there. And the next thing I'm hoping people get out of it, and this is very subjective, this is my subjective opinion, I feel like we're getting to become a more lonely, distant, and angry world. And I spent 35 years dealing with really bad folks. I say that in a very flippant way, but you know what I mean. I dealt with the worst of humanity. And now I'm writing about what if we chose to be the best of humanity? And I do that by surrounding myself with great people that I get to go fishing with. And I very rarely meet a fly angler who isn't a pretty awesome person. We just seem to draw a good tribe in general. So those three things, that I hope they come out with more knowledge, but more than knowledge, kind of a feel that they want to do something about it. I hope they come out of it feeling they connected with the stories. And I hope they come out of it feeling more hopeful and empowered, because it's so easy now, I think, for us to look at the news, to be on the internet, and to think, oh, wow, the world just seems hopeless, and it's not. So those are what I think people should get out of it, I hope.
Sounds good. Sounds good. Let me take a quick break here. We'll come back and continue talking with Steve Ramirez about his books, the Casting series. So hang tight, folks, and we'll be right back. The Ugly Bug Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming, has been serving fly fishers in Wyoming and around the world since 1983. Their selection of top-of-the-line gear and a huge assortment of flies is one of the best in the land. All products are available in their fly shop and online. Looking for advice? Just give them a call, and their expert professional staff will help you with whatever you need. Visit the Ugly Bug Fly Shop today at uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. 866-845-9284 or visit their website at the Ugly Bug Fly Shop. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Steve Ramirez about casting homeward. If you'd like to ask Steve a question, go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and fill out that form, and we'll see if we can't get your question answered tonight on the show. Okay. Steve, we did get a couple of questions in here on the internet. Mark in Connecticut wrote in, and he said, "Your way with words imbues your books with descriptions that have so much clarity, it's as if the reader is looking over your shoulder at the scenes you describe. My question is, what authors and works have influenced your writing?"
Wow, Mark, that's a great question. And I don't know if they've influenced my writing, influenced my thinking maybe. So in my younger years, I read, like a lot of young men, I read Ernest Hemingway as much as I could. I've also read other things, Steinbeck and Jack London and Russ Annabelle and all the outdoor writers. And I started to decide which ones I really got something out of and enjoyed and which ones I didn't, which were great storytellers. Another one, Peter Hathaway Capstick, is a hunting writer. He's gone now, but he's a great storyteller. But I read really widely. I'm usually reading two or three books at a time. And so other books that didn't teach me anything about writing, but a lot about life, it would be things like Sapiens by Yuval Harari and Raiding Sweetgrass. I mean, so many books that I read. To put it in perspective, about a year ago, I donated 4 pickup truckloads of books to our public library here in Texas.
Sounds like something I should be doing.
So I donated them, and my friend Bob White had said to me, "I want to see the ones that you kept." And yeah, there's a very small amount that I've kept that are permanently part of my collection until I'm not here anymore. And I took a picture of it and sent it to Bob. So I would say, when I was looking at the way people write, it's either nonfiction storytellers like Capstick, or it's been looking at fiction storytellers like Hemingway. And I really enjoy not only reading, I'll also say, I'm going to draw a blank. He wrote No Country for Old Men and various other books. He's a Texan too, and I'm drawing the blank. Great, great writer. But anyhow, when I read them, I'm also paying attention to how are they crafting it. So when I write these stories, I think Hemingway is the one that said that books aren't written, they're edited. And he meant himself, and that's what I do. I edit myself quite a bit. I write very raw. I put it out there. I don't stop myself, and then I go back and I reread. When I read a book and I think this is truly good writing, then I pay attention to what are they doing. Where's the alchemy here? Because to me, stories are powerful. Stories are what move whole civilizations. And I guess a little bit I'm hoping to move things a notch myself. Boy, so that's what I pay attention to. I don't know if I've done a really good job of answering this question, but when you read so many books, it'd be hard for me to nail it down. I can tell right away if I'm reading something I'm going to keep going with it or not. And it's not always the ones that are the classics. I won't say the names of some of them, but there's some in our genre of literature that are the great classics, and they may have sold many more copies than I ever will, but I start reading them and I think, I can't take this.
I always love a book where, you know, because I tend to read nonfiction in the morning and then fiction at night, you know, before going to
great
bed.
Great plan.
Yeah, and it's always like, God, I hate to put this down. I mean, you know, I mean, I have to wait till tomorrow night to continue, you know, then you know you're in a good book, you know.
I agree.
And
I was thinking of Cormac McCarthy, and if you've read The Road, that is a book that you turn the page and you turn the page and you turn the page. Now, I don't think all books have to be that, because I actually am a slow reader usually. because I read with a highlighter and an ink pen with me. And the books that I've
Okay.
kept, whoever gets them after I'm not here anymore are going to find all my little notes in the corners of what it made me think of and what my ideas were about it. So, yeah, I tear books apart very carefully and very respectfully, and that's what I do. As a kid,
Roy,
it was Hemingway.
Hemingway, yeah. Rory Fukushima in California asks, when and where did you start fly fishing? And what is your favorite place to fly fish? And what would be the target species? Sam Johnson basically asked the same question, so we'll let you hit both those.
Okay. Well, the first part of that's real easy, and the second part's near impossible. So the first part of where did I start fly fishing, I am a self-taught fly angler. And I learned right here in Texas by picking up a rod, getting a VHS of Mel Krieger so I could learn the basic stroke and trying to teach myself. When I wrote Casting Four, the only person I had ever fished with in my life beside my father as a kid, and he fished with a spinning rod, was my daughter. And I taught her to cast based on what I knew. So here I was well into my life, and I had never fished with anyone other than myself. So with that, you get the amount of skill that you can teach yourself, which is to say not much. And after that, I started fishing with all these wonderful people that I met along the way for the other books. And so hopefully my skill level has been going up with surrounding myself with really talented people. Now, the next thing I think they both asked was, what is your favorite place to fish? And what is your favorite target species? And that is much more difficult for me to say. So I'll try to answer it. I don't know that I can say there's one place that's my favorite place to fish. I can tell you the places I like to go back to again and again. That would help. I love fishing off Montauk, New York, and Long Island with my buddy David Blinken, and I would do it every time he ever invites me. So that's a place I love. I love fishing for Corbina off the coast of L.A. On the beach right there. I absolutely adore fishing in Bristol Bay area of Alaska. And all of these places are very, very different. I love chasing bonefish in the Caribbean. And I just came back from fishing with my buddy Gary Bula down in Baja, in La Ventana.
Yeah.
And I am forever hooked on that, pardon the pun. And if anybody ever wants to go do that, you should definitely do it. I guess I'll add one more in there. I was just down in Campeche, my buddy Raul with the Tarpon Town, and I have a blast down there. That place is just, I'll go there every time they let me go. So with that said, these are all my favorite places I've been, and you notice there's not a little the freshwater trout waters mentioned in there. I guess my favorite place I've ever fished, gosh, that's so hard. In Casting Homeward, I went down the Snake River with the guide up there, Boots Allen, a good friend of my dear friends, Randall and Mary Kaufman. And Mary and I went down the Snake, and I have to say, that was just glorious. I mean, I would do that if I didn't get to fish.
Yeah, that's a beautiful river. Yeah.
Yeah, it's fantastic. What else I loved about it is it's native. I'm not catching. I'm sorry for people like my friend Kurt Dieter, and they love brown trout, and I like them too. If I catch them in Scotland, but I love catching native, gorgeous Snake River cutthroats on the Snake River. So it's really hard for me to nail that down. I guess when someone says, well, okay, you've got to pick a fish in a place. Okay, here you go. My state fish, the Guadalupe bass, found only here in our crystal clear spring-fed rivers in the Texas Hill Country, if I have to pick one.
There you go. Okay.
So that was your long-winded answer. I hope they're happy.
Really? Yeah, I hope so, too. Yeah,
don't ask a guy that's fished all over the place.
Yeah, I know it's a tough question to answer because each experience and each fish, for me, there's different parts that I love.
Right. And it's not just about the fish for me or the fishing.
Yeah. It's like hooking up with a big tarpon is wonderful, But the fight isn't so much fun, It's because it can be long and drawn out, and then but baby tarpon and Campeche, can you get the same kind of action, but the fight isn't so long, so you get to do it again sooner. So yeah,
Right.
it's each fish has their own little thing that they give back to you, and just some of them it's the chase, some of them it's the fight, some of them it's where you have to go to get them, and yeah, it's and each one
Well,
has its own beauty.
yeah, and for me anyway, it's about much more than the fish and the fishing. It's the whole enchilada. I'm saying that I just came back from Mexico. It's the food, it's the music, it's the friends, it's the experience of the whole thing. If all I was doing is trying to catch big fish, well, I guess I could do that in the canal outside Phoenix, but I don't know that I want to.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. When we I went to Campeche and fished with Enrico Puglisi down there and stayed at his little lodge, which is wonderful. And he cooked us a meal that night, went and got some fresh octopus, because octopus is a thing, in
Big deal down there,
Campeche.
right?
And yeah, some big shrimp, and we grilled them, and he cooked they
You're
grilled
making
the
me hungry.
octopus, and yeah, we had a wonderful dinner, and that was, oh, what a great way to end the day. But so I hear you totally. In Casting Homeward, you wrote several chapters about Alaska,
Right.
and you were, from what you were saying just a few minutes ago, because I was going to ask you the first time, but you've been there before, so I'm going to ask you what drew you back there again. And
I'll tell you, when I came up with the concept that I was going to do Casting Homeward as the final book of that series, and that's what it was going to be focused on, Homeward. What is the place we call home? How do we define it? I was talking with my dear buddy Bob White, who does, I'm so grateful, does the artwork for my books. He does them for John Gearhawk, and he's just an amazing artist and a great person. And we were just having a chat, and I said, what is the home waters of your heart, the place if you that was where you're going? And I truly thought he was going to say something like the St. Croix River, which he lives quite close to, or the Flambeau, and I fished all those with him, and they're gorgeous. But he didn't. He said the Wood River drainage of Bristol Bay, and then he said, and the River Malo region of Argentina. And I asked him why, and he said, well, we talked about Bristol Bay, and he said, well, I've been guiding there since I was a young guy, and it's where I, learned everything. It's where I met my wife. It's where it's just, I had all these memories of this place. And we ended up going there, and I said, well, I'd like to see that. So we ended up going up there. So the first part was, it was important to my dear friend. The second thing that drew me up there is I'm basically also an environmental writer. I'm not just writing fishing stories. And I wanted to write the story about Bristol Bay because Bristol Bay is, I believe, a truly important fight for all of us to pull behind and save. And this is the interesting thing about it. So many places where TU or others are working, they're working to repair the damage we've already created. It's already been heavily decimated in many ways, but Bristol Bay is still largely, I mean, every part of the world has been touched by humanity. But Bristol Bay still is largely intact. But that could end with a stroke of a pen. So I wanted to get up there and see it and experience it for myself, and I did. And I have to say that if for those people who haven't been up there, and everybody has a different experience, they may say, oh, well, the fishing was great, and that's all they thought about it. But for me, I'm grasping everything. I'm learning from the indigenous people there. I'm enjoying the food, the wildlife, the flying. I love being in a float plane and landing on some distant place. And so that's why I went up there, to have that entire experience and then to try to translate that into words so that when people read those five chapters, they feel like they're there with me. So that's what drew me up there. It's always the people, the place, the story. That's what drew
Had
me
you
up
been
there.
to
And
Bristol Bay before, or were you in a different part of
no.
Alaska the first
No, in
time?
Casting Seaward, I decided I wanted to hit southeast Alaska. So now I've been to two main areas of Alaska. I would like to go again to a different area. But in Casting Seaward, that's where I followed salmon all the way up to the tiniest tributaries with a friend and trout unlimited biologist Mark Hieronymus. And so, yes, I've seen two different visions of Alaska, and there's many more than that I know. But I've been able to see both places and see what's going on there and why these places are, many people listening here have been to Alaska, and many haven't, but I have to say, if it doesn't change your life and your views in some way about how beautiful things can be and how wild things can be and how much it matters, it should. If it doesn't do that for you, then you're probably half dead inside. So,
go ahead.
It's a pretty amazing place.
Yeah. Let me take a quick break. We'll come back to Alaska here and talk more about that beautiful place. Discover the power of pure Skagit with Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics. From delicate soft hackles to hefty steelhead flies, OPST's versatile casting system meets the demands of every angling situation. With Ed Ward's unparalleled Skagit rod design and casting expertise, OPST offers you a quicker route to mastering effective casting techniques, whether battling wind and rain or targeting steelhead, trout, or smallmouth bass. Trust OPST's innovative rods, lines, and tips to elevate your fishing experience. Join the ranks of skilled anglers who rely on OPST for consistency, proficiency, and a superior fly fishing adventure. Unleash your potential with OPST today. Visit PierceGadget.com or call them at 206-858-8476. 206-858-8476, or visit their website at PierceGadget.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Steve Ramirez about casting homeward. If you'd like to ask Steve a question, just fill out that form on our homepage, send it in, and we'll see if we can't get Steve to answer it. Let's see here. So, yeah, what was your experience in Bristol Bay? What did you do there? You know, what did you fish for?
Well, I fished pretty far and wide. I was pretty fortunate. So I got to fish for multiple species of salmon, from king salmon to, you know, coho. And we fished for all the species of salmon that were going through there, also for big rainbows and Dolly Varden, which I love fishing for, and some Arctic char. And then the one I really wanted to get the most when I was there, which was Arctic grayling. And so we got to do all of that in different parts. I fished from the center of the Wood River drainage on the Alagoas, and then all the way out to the western shores, way out in the very far out on the west side, and then all the way down to where there's Walrus Island, and up on the Rainbow, and then ultimately on the Wrong Turn River, I think it is. Yeah, Wrong Turn River. So just the whole area, plus doing some flyouts and landing on lakes in the middle of paradise.
Did you stay in one place and fish, fly
I
out from that
did
one
both.
Lodge or something?
Did okay. both. I did fishing from the lodge, which was Bristol Bay Lodge, which I totally loved. And we fished the Agulawak from there. So you're going out on boats. And then we also flew out to the further out rivers and stayed in tent camps, very nice tent camps. And sometimes we did hops where you just fly out, land on the lake, do your fishing, fly back. And I've already told you that I'm addicted to flying and float planes. Absolutely love it.
Yeah.
And when people say, aren't you afraid of dying? I said, well, if I die, I'll die happy. I mean,
when we flew out there, we went to the Togiak River in Bristol Bay and flew out on a widgeon. I don't know if you know what a widgeon is, but
No, I don't.
It's a plane that lands in the water, okay? So it's got kind of a belly of a fish almost. And then the wheels come out, and then it'll pull up on a gravel bar. So it's kind of an amphibious plane. But I remember we took off in Dillingham, and it was pouring rain, and he crabbed. As soon as his wheels left the ground, we were in crab position taking off in the storm. And then later, he just takes the sunglasses off, puts them on the dashboard, and he's flying between mountains, and we're looking at moose down below, you know. And it's like, this guy did it so casually, you know. It was like, oh, he's just, you know, driving over to the grocery store or something, you know.
Oh, sure.
It's like, yeah, they are amazing, those pilots. I'm totally impressed with them.
Yeah, I became pretty tight with some of the pilots, and one in particular, in one point, he said to me, so do you want to fly the plane? And I said, yeah. And then we saw the other clients in the back had the look on their face. He said, maybe we'll try to do it another time. So I was ready.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
we were in De Havilland Beavers, which.
Yeah. That's the gold standard up there, you know.
Oh, yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would do it just to fly around in those things. The fishing was.
Was there a particular species that impressed you?
I would say, well, first of all, they're all great. I'm not going to just hedge on this. I'm going to tell you the fish that I wanted to catch the most, and I mentioned it was Arctic grayling, and I was not disappointed.
Yeah.
It was the first fish I wanted to go after. It's the first one I caught. It was the last fish I wanted to go after and the last one I caught.
Oh.
And on the Wrong Turn River, I caught a good-sized grayling that the guide said was the grayling of a lifetime. Now, I know this can be guide talk, so I took it in stride, like having a date and her saying, you're the best-looking man I've ever seen. I'm not going to take that seriously. So, but I would say I love catching grayling the most. It's just something I've always wanted to do there. Now, impressed me, I caught accidentally caught a chum salmon, which nobody gives any respect to, and
right.
I do. I think they're quite beautiful, and doesn't matter to me how they are to eat. And I was trying not to catch salmon, actually, on this river because they were spawning. The chums were spawning, so I'm trying to miss them. I'm going for the Dolly Varden and for the rainbows that are trying to pick off the eggs coming out of the nest. And this female chum, this hen comes, big one, comes flying out and grabs a hold of the fly anyway. I'm trying to get it away from it. And that one impressed me. And I'll just tell you really quick the story because it ran me down. I had to get out of the boat. We couldn't keep up with it. It ran me down the river, down a gravel bar covered in bear scat. And it was a battle. And when I finally landed her, I walked her all the way back up the river so I could put her back in her red. Make sure she was fully recovered and just walked her all the way up by, talked to her. So yeah, she left a lasting impression on me because this is a fish that was at the end of her life, but still had that fight. So,
yeah.
Hope that's
a
good answer for you. That one fish.
Yeah.
I'll
yeah.
Never forget.
You know, it's funny because when we went to Bristol Bay, the cohos, silvers were late coming in. And we caught a ton of chum salmon, and they were a blast. I mean, they weren't on their reds or anything, but they were fresh out of the sea. And yeah, I didn't even know what a chum salmon was at that point. You know, it was all new to me, and I was totally impressed by them. They're fun to catch. Yeah. So.
Oh, I absolutely love them. They fought in so many different ways, and that fish wore me out. And so I thought the best thing I can do is get her back home, and I did. I walked her all the way up.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. How did, you know, did fishing in Alaska change how you think and feel about the natural world or how you think about fishing?
I don't think it changed me. It kept expanding where I've been going anyway. So my ideas about fishing and about our interaction with nature has been growing. I say now that I'm a 63-year-old, 6-year-old, because I think the older I get, the more childlike I'm becoming, the more I'm in awe with nature. And Alaska is a big awe. So I think it expanded even more because even though I was way out there, I could definitely see the impact on nature where they were having flooding like they've never had before, where I'm fishing in the treetops of the willows to catch grayling and on what's supposed to be a grayling island, but there's no island left anymore. It didn't change me. It made me feel more urgent that we need to, if we truly love nature and we truly love our rivers and we truly love our fish, we better start doing something about it and paying attention and waking up. But yeah, I guess the only other way it is changing is it's so good to look down from a plane or to hike across a river and see how much space there still is left in America. in these places. And for me, that makes me feel good. Even if I don't get there very much, I want to know wilderness is there. I don't want it to see it covered in roads.
Yeah, so the thing with me in Alaska, I'm going to throw a little water on your fire here, but because like we talked about before the show, as I grew up there in Anchorage, is, and this is just a thing, we could just talk about this from a general standpoint of too many people, not enough resources. And I've seen that in Alaska. I've seen that in Colorado,
everywhere,
where I live now. Yeah. And
Texas.
You say there's a lot of wild open space, but it's shrinking. I was talking to Will Blair. Will Blair is a guide who was for years running trips to Kamchatka, you know, and and so he's been Alaska. He's guided in Alaska. And we were just talking about a couple of rivers he went up there to fish and was really pretty disappointed because in the old days, you know, fishing was so much better.
Of course, everywhere.
Yeah. And so it's still a place someone should go as soon as possible because more and more people, like when we went there, we drove up the dirt Alcan Highway, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now it's paved. And now there are caravans of RVs going up there and places my dad and I used to have the whole river to ourselves are now shoulder to shoulder. You know, these are places outside of Anchorage I'm talking about, but you pretty much have to fly in to go to be alone anymore. So,
sure.
You know, it's kind of my thought on it. Is
you're not throwing any water there because I agree with you. When I mentioned about, so remember, I lived in Africa too, and I have everywhere I've gone, I have not found a place that isn't shrinking, it isn't in trouble. When I was in Southeast Alaska, what I saw was that those glaciers are vanishing fast. And the mining companies love it, by the way, because every time the ice slides back, they can make a new claim. So, and I was in Peru, and I'm in the middle of the Andes in Peru, and the guide I'm with is saying, when I was a boy, all these mountains were covered in snow, and there was no snow on any of those mountains around us, none. There were no glaciers, none. This is the Andes. We went up to 15,000 feet on a 21,000 foot or 20,000 foot. I'm trying to remember how high Salkantay Mountain is. It's pretty high. So where I've gone, including Alaska, I've seen that impact. Mm-hmm. And I'm always stuck with, somebody got very upset with me once when I was sharing this, I'm always stuck with looking at a place and saying, I wish I could see it before we all got here.
Yeah.
I don't mean that would be something I'd want to live there and die in that, because we do need each other. But there's too many of us. We have 8 billion humans on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
It's too many. So, yeah, too many people. I'm with you on that. And And I want us to, when I write about this, people will notice I don't say I caught it. I say I caught him or her. I'm trying to get more anglers to pay attention that these things are alive and the rivers are alive. So here in the Texas Hill Country, for example, last year and the year before were the first times I know of in history that's been recorded where whole sections of the Guadalupe River went dry to the stone and everything died.
Oh, boy.
And the desert is moving east. I know every corner of this land here, and I've seen the change. I've seen the plants changing. I've seen the wildlife changing. It's happening fast. So you haven't thrown any cold water. That's why I mentioned Bristol Bay is about as good as we're going to get on the places we're talking about, because Southeast Alaska was very much scarred up in many ways with logging roads and other things. And that's why you hear me even move away from the word resource. And I studied natural resources in college. So, because I want us to say, hey, that's a forest. And the thing with salmon need bears and bears need salmon. And salmon need clean water and they need the right amount of water.
I did
I'm with you.
I did a show with Bill Horn. I don't know if you've met or talked to Bill Horn yet, but
no,
did a show called Bristol Bay Sockeye Salmon and Rainbow Trout. You might want to listen to that because he's talking about the importance of the sockeye to that whole ecosystem. and
Right.
how, you know, that's what the rainbow trout are all about, is the sockeye. But sockeye are not a sport fish per se. They're vegetarians and they're kind
Right.
of hard
You
to
can
catch.
catch them,
And
but they're
yeah.
not. Yeah,
Yeah.
and most of the ones
They're
I
not
saw
like
were
the other ones.
right.
Yeah, we're turning
And
color already and that kind of thing. So, yeah.
but those sockeye, and that's the largest sockeye population in the world, to my understanding.
Right. Yeah.
And the difference also I see in Bristol Bay is, unlike places like Southeast Alaska and most of the lower 48, it is not as impacted on by hatchery fish. And
No, no,
if you go to
no.
Southeast Alaska, a big part of the population being counted of salmon are actually hatchery fish. So you can't get a fix on how healthy the ecosystem is and the wild fish are. And these are the things I write about without beating people over the head of. I want them to travel with me and see how much these places are beautiful and the people are wonderful and there's so much to be happy about, but there's also a lot for us to do. And there's too many of us, you're right.
Yeah. You also wrote about Montana and casting homeward. What did you discover there? What unique experience did you have there? Because again, Montana is probably one of the most visited states in the lower 48 for
Right.
fishing. So, yeah.
So, when I got out of the Marine Corps, I went to University of Montana for 1 year. And so I lived there a long, long time ago. This was 40 years ago. So I got to see, this is the first time I've been back to Montana since 40 years ago. And it's beautiful. The rivers are beautiful. I wish more of them were native fish and not just catching rainbows and brown trout, but they are what they are. But what I saw in Montana is kind of what we've been talking about. I don't want to be a downer, but there's a lot going on there. Some of it's because of how many of us are fishing it. Some of it is because how many of us are moving to these places. And some of it is most definitely related to the change in the climate, in my opinion. And so if you look at like the Bighorn River, everywhere I've traveled, people say you can go anywhere. You can go to the Amazon, and people say the fishing was so much better 20 years ago or 40 years ago. And of course it
Of
was. It's
course.
the common denominator is us and how many of us are doing it. So as anglers, when I'm fishing here in the Texas Hill Country, I've actually gone fishing when I won't fish when I know that the fish are going to be stressed from the heat. I don't go at all. I have actually fished with no hook on my fly, and I don't go when they're stressed. So I'm taking care of the thing that I say I love. And that's why I keep writing, every angler a naturalist. If we pay attention, I'm not just, so every time we catch a fish, what we're actually showing is we've learned something about that fish. We learned about its habitat, what it feeds on. We've learned about the currents. We learned how to read a river. Those are all beautiful things that fly fishing does for you. But if the only reason you're doing it is to see if you can catch a bigger fish than your buddy, you haven't gone very deep. There's so much more. So I loved my time in Montana, and I was drawn there again by the people. I was there with my friend Sue Kerber and her partner Josh. And the other reason I was drawn there back there is because, as I mentioned, my first book, Casting Forward, was in the movie Mending the Line, and I wanted to fish the exact rivers that are in the movie, so I did in Paradise Valley. And it was gorgeous. Loved it. Loved every bit of it. But I definitely could tell the difference from when I lived there 40 years ago.
Oh,
I can
sure. Yeah.
see it's gotten
Yeah.
hammered, and I can see that we're going to have more and more rivers going like the Smith is, where not everybody can go there all the time. You have to wait your turn.
Well,
And that's just.
that's you brought up the things that have affected fishing, including us and so forth. But one of the things that's a big factor, I think, in Montana and in the Rockies, Wyoming, Colorado, is private land. So you have these people buying up huge ranches and the access is limited. So then that funnels all of us down into more limited areas, because we can't fish these private areas. And, the water rights where you can't put your foot on the bottom of the river, restricts you even more. So yeah, it's kind of a pet peeve of mine. It's like, it's getting more pay to play as every year passes. And it's not cheap. It's not cheap.
No, and I don't think we should have nature in any way, including fly fishing, be something only for the wealthy. I get to go on some trips that I could never afford because someone invited me. So that's, I'm lucky that way. But I don't, another friend of mine, Richard Louv, wrote the book Last Child in the Woods, and he actually, if people pay attention, a lot of anglers won't know who Richard is. They should find out who he is. I'm grateful that he wrote the foreword for Casting Homeward. And in his book, Last Child in the Woods, he's talking about nature deficit disorder, he calls it, how much more and more people are being pushed out of nature. So we have this real problem where there's too many of us, and yet as we stop connecting, we lose interest, and we think pavement's okay. So I think we're going to have to find that balance. That's why I mentioned the Smith River, and there's other places. I would like to see more control down here on the Devil's River. We need to protect these places, and even if sometimes what we're doing is saying, I'm not going to go there and as often. So, yeah, I'm with you. Access is important, but the other side to that is I'm huge. I think I hear you saying public land, and I want more public land, not less public land. I live in a state that has almost no public land. Everything's a big ranch. And in casting forward, I wrote that what I want to see is for people who have the money and the government to get in here as these ranchers are selling off to developers and buy this land, put it out of
play. Like the Nature Conservancy and, you know.
Right. And that's why I'm a big supporter of Nature Conservancy, and I put it in every book I have. Because you know, they're doing the only way you do it, buy the land, and now you can't have it. You cannot put the condos there now. You cannot drain it. Now, we still have to protect the water because some people are buying land just so they can sink a well and drain that water.
Right.
So in Texas, we have water rights in Texas that are from 1909. That needs a change. It basically says as much water as you can suck out of the ground from your property as you can have.
Yeah, the other thing is, you know, you talk about public lands. Even some of the public lands we have aren't accessible to us. For instance, the Grand Canyon or many of the wild rivers in Utah and Colorado, where less than 10% of the permits to, you know, do whitewater trips through those areas are for the public. The rest is commercial. So you can go on a commercial trip tomorrow, but you got to wait 12 years or be in a lottery to get on one of these rivers, you know, on your own.
It's tough.
And that's public land. That's public land, but it's controlled by commercial outfitters. And nothing against commercial outfitters, but, you know, when you as a private individual can only access it 10% of the time and have to wait 12 years, that's not fair either. So, in my mind.
The world we have with 8 billion people is at some point something's going to have to give. We're not going to have access to everything we always want when we want it. But with that said, I totally hear you. I wish I would like to see us anglers take the lead in this. In many ways we have, but we can keep going more. And I know you're going to move me east through the book, so we can do that. And it'll still, as we move east from Montana and Alaska, you're going to see that the things you're talking about become even more. And that's why I do these books this way. There's a story and a story and a story. And at the end, people go, ah. And that's what I
want.
Let's take
a quick break and then come back and talk about the East Coast here. Yeah, exactly where I was going next. So hang tight, and we'll be right back. Fly Fishers International needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. The organization provides grants to help with the restoration of habitats like Wolf Creek in Idaho and Sands Creek in Delaware County, New York, and funds projects that collect valuable data about fish and their habitats like the Peacock Bass Study in Miami, Florida. FFI serves as a strong advocate for fly fishing in all waters for all types of fish, and to preserve and promote the arts of fly casting and fly tying, and to help ensure future generations can continue to enjoy these one-of-a-kind experiences. These efforts won't be nearly as effective without your help. If you're not already a member, we invite you to join Fly Fishers International as they work to cultivate conservation, education, and community within the sport of fly fishing. Join Fly Fishers International today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to their website at flyfishersinternational.org. Again, that's flyfishersinternational.org. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Steve Ramirez about Casting Homeward. If you'd like to ask Steve a question, fill out that form on the homepage, and we'll see if we can't get it answered for you. Okay, Steve.
Yeah.
Let me just check here. Yeah, it just struck me as I was doing that commercial break there was all these. I've been doing these shows since 2006. And we talk about a lot of these things. I hope somebody 50 years from now will listen and go, look at what those old guys talked about back then, you know, and I wonder what they'll be facing at that point in time, you know.
That's a great comment, and I have to say, I'm going to say something that's my subjective opinion, which everybody has one, is if we don't act right now, and I think it's almost too late, if we don't start acting right now on many, many levels, what they'll be saying is, do you remember when they used to fish?
Could be
Do you
that.
remember? We're talking about how the Big Hole River used to be so much better, and Alaska used to be so much better, and Penn's Creek used to be so much better. But what we really need to understand is they could end up being nothing. They could be end up being devoid of fish in 50 years. I won't be here for it.
Yeah,
But
me neither.
these places could very much, there's that's why I have used quotes from The Road, the book The Road, for anybody who's read it. Because it talks about the almost, well, an apocalyptic point of view, and we're not far. Things fall apart quickly, and that's why one of the things I repeat in all my books is everything's connected to everything. And whether we're talking about people, whether we're talking about ecosystems, so casting seaward, I'll say this really quick because I know we don't have that much time. I went into the whole lifestyle of what people call a sand crab. Or a sand flea, it depends on where you're at, what they call them. And how if that one creature collapses, which it could very well do, because they're starting to show up with heavy metals in them, a whole list of creatures and fish and wildlife collapse with it. So yeah, I think that's a great comment. Hopefully we're speaking now and it actually causes us to do something together rather than saying, oh, I will hope somebody does something. Well, that should be us. Anglers have a lot of, we have a lot we can do. So, moving east.
It's going to be like, I remember when Grandpa used to fish and he took me a few
Yeah.
times, you know, it's like,
Right. It.
So you did go out east. You went to the Catskills, spent a few of my high school years there in the Catskills, and it's considered the birthplace of American fly fishing. What were your thoughts fishing there? I don't think I need to ask. Well, let me ask you, why did you go there? I can guess, but let me hear it from your mouth.
Well, as you know, I went through Pennsylvania and then up through there, and I was kind of following the history of classic fly fishing. I purposely put this as America's legendary rivers. It's more tongue-in-cheek than anything. So yes, I'm going to some legendary rivers, but I'm also asking the question, well, why do we call this one legendary? And you'll see that I went to some creeks and rivers that would people say, well, why that's legendary? Well, it's because this was Dave Whitlock's favorite place to fish. That makes it legendary. So, what brought me to the Catskills is a couple of things. One is there's always a person involved. So I was fishing with my friend Josh Caldwell, who's the director of the movie Mending the Line, and that's where he lives, and that's his home area. And so a person brought me there in each case, and a story brought me there. I wanted to fish in this beautiful, I'll say wild place, but we all know that everything's been a bit domesticated by us. And it's right outside New York City and provides most of the water for you in New York City. I wanted to kind of end on that note, sort of. I end up in Texas, but I wanted to end on that note of this place that is still quite beautiful, where history shows how long ago people started using a fly to catch trout. And back then they were catching mostly native trout, and now you're mostly going to be catching brown trout and rainbows, though I did catch brookies there. I wanted to go into that history. I wanted to dove into why is this place so special and what makes it special today. And I'm really glad I did. And I also wanted to show that you could be right outside New York City, right outside a huge metropolis, and you can have something beautiful and wild. As a matter of fact, I'll argue that our cities should have clean water running through them with fishing for kids. This is America. I can't believe we think so small that we think that can't happen. I mean, why not? Why not urban fishing for kids that is clean? Just make it happen. You know, we can send someone to the moon. We can't clean up a river. So anyway, I wanted to go and see that, and I wanted to see through the eyes of my friends that were there, and I fished with several great people that have become my friends, who all find the Catskills, and I'll say also Western Connecticut as their home, because I went up to the Farmington. I'm so glad I did. But here's the other part. I wanted to watch the difference in the way we humans behave from place to place. You know, I grew up in the South. We take things kind of slowly. We say, yes, ma'am, yes, sir. We might have a shotgun in the back of our truck, but we're polite about it.
Only shoot you if you're running, huh?
No, it's okay if you run. So,
I don't know.
but it was really interesting for me to learn. You're talking about people and resources. Some of the best friends I have made are from the northeast of the United States, and I've fished with them in waters that I absolutely adore. And I can't wait to go back fishing with them again. But I was able to see why the culture was much quicker. Let's hurry up. Let's get to the river. Let's get to our spot. Let's, you know, I mean, I'm used to sitting on the back of a pickup truck and talking with my buddies for a while as we meander up to the river. And when I'm in the Northeast with my friends, I know they're like Superman. They've got their gear on faster than I can get out of the truck. And I realize it's because if you don't get to your spot in time, somebody else has got it. It took me a while to figure that out when I live in an area where I can fish in the upper streams around here and never see another angler. I saw one once in one of my favorite backwater streams, and this is in 20 some years. I felt like someone was dating my wife. I was so upset that he was standing there. So I'm used to having solitude when I want it, and I got to the Northeast, and I'm on the yellow breeches, and there's a person every 50 feet. So, but saying that, I have come to love the Catskills area and Western, also in Vermont. I've come to love that area. I've come to love the people and the waters, but there's a lot of us.
Well, and then in
So
the East has been used to that kind of, the amount of people on the rivers. You always used to see those opening day pictures in the East, shoulder to shoulder, on the river. And out
I
west,
kind
we
of
don't really have an opening day, right? It's just always
right.
open.
And then in the East, of course, the pressure's so heavy that most of the places I fished in the East are largely, these are fish that have been put there, you know, through hatcheries. Because there's no other way the habitat could sustain the fish because they're being caught and caught and caught and caught. So at some point we're gonna have to decide, well, what kind of angling experience do we want to have, and what are we willing to give up for that to happen? Are we willing to give up our frequency of it, or what are we willing to give up? I don't know what the answer is going to be, but I'm really grateful that in the writing of this book, I got to travel all the way across America and then end up back here in my home, and experience this country through the eyes of the people. And I really do believe we have more in common than we have that separates us. I really do. I found that no matter where I am, if I'm fishing with anglers and I'm out there with people, that there's a lot of good folks here that care about their home waters and their homelands. And so, and that's why I'm very involved with Bristol Bay. I don't live in Alaska. I just got done being the host of a show through Guadalupe Valley, Guadalupe River Trout Unlimited, that we were working with the United Tribes of Bristol Bay to do this show to raise awareness and raise some funds for Bristol Bay, because it's still a fight. So people say, well, why are you interested in that when you're in Texas? Well, this is all our land, all our water. It's all, if you
Well,
let
it's
one,
the world, right?
it's the world. This is a global issue, a global problem. And we're also starting to set standards, you know, where we think, well, don't. So when I was a kid, my dad used to kill snakes as soon as he saw them, because that's the way he was raised. And I started teaching him about how important they were, and by the time I was done, my dad never killed a snake. He would pick it up with a stick and move it off the road like I did. We can do that. We just need to change the way we see things, and because I want kids way down the road to see the beauty that you and I are seeing. I want them to to have that experience of catching that fish and watching it swim off. Or like in Alaska, when we're catching salmon and we catch a certain amount because we're doing it legally, and they end up in the frying pan. And that was beautiful too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, there are some positive stories about cleaning up the rivers. Even, you know, in Colorado, here in downtown Denver now, they've cleaned up the Platte, and you can have some incredible carp fishing down there. Huge carp, downtown Denver, you know, with the high rises going up, and it used to be there wasn't a fish in that river. Now, yeah, it's
Why not
a salmon river. It's not a trout river, but it's an excellent carp river. So
I know. Yeah. And it could be an excellent warm water river, and with all the other wildlife that goes with it, I'm with the San Antonio River going right through downtown San Antonio. I don't go to the Riverwalk. It's where tourists tend to go, but when I have gone there because there's a visitor, I'm amazed at how many people don't see the plain-bellied water snakes that are sitting on the trees and all the wildlife that's all around them while they're going to the restaurant to get their fajitas. Why not have every city? Why shouldn't every kid be growing up with that? So, I love the work of...
Just visiting, we were in Truckee, or in Reno, and went up to Truckee in the Lake Tahoe area. But this little apartment that we had in Reno, we were looking right down. They had a river walk there, too, on the Truckee River. And they had built the structure and stuff in downtown Reno in the river and so forth. And I'm looking down from 13 stories down, and I can see three people fly fishing right in the downtown area of Reno. And I thought, that's really cool, you know? Yeah. See the guy's wet footprints going on the sidewalk from his waders, you know, stuff. Mm-hmm. It's, and
I see
there's
that.
A beauty
I see
to that.
In every town.
Yeah.
Sure, I want to
yeah.
see that in every town. My daughter lives in a town in England where all over town they have signs that say, friendly. That's what it says, because that's what they remind each other to be. But all over that town, they have community gardens and orchards where people just come and pick their own fruit, and the community helps keep it going. And they have community paths for, you know, nature walk with your kids. And why not? Why don't we have this? So, yeah, I think us anglers have a lot we can teach ourselves and a lot we can teach the world. And it's a whole lot more than how many fish I can catch. I have days where I'm fishing, where I'm catching fish after fish, and I just snip off, and I think, well, you've had enough.
Yeah. Did you started, like you mentioned, you started casting homeward in Texas, and you ended in Texas.
Right.
What makes Texas so special to you?
Well, it's casting homeward, and I've traveled, as I mentioned, four continents and 21 countries and many, many, many states, and I've found beautiful things everywhere, but I was really struggling with the idea of how do I decide what's home. And I have to tell you, no matter how great it was in the Baja, no matter how great it was in Montana, I'm happy to come home. And I did this purposely because, I mean, everything I write is on purpose. All my books in this series, I don't know that I'm going to do it with the next series, but they all have 21 chapters, which is just arbitrarily tied into the solstice. There's all kinds of symbolism I put in here. And this is symbolism too, full circle. I mean, everything in nature is a circle, from a bird's nest to the ripples in water. Full circle back home, the Texas Hill Country, not Texas as a whole, Texas Hill Country specifically is my home. And I'm able to take people on this journey with me from these wild, wild places all the way over to cities and then bring them back here to where I live and tell them why this place is so precious to me, just like their home is to them, and why it's disappearing. I mean, the proximate cause is us. So, yeah, I am a bit doing a call. I always say I have a lot of hope, but to me, hope is an action word. It's not a thing like I hope someone fixes this for me. I mean, I'm a Marine. We do things. So that's why I bring it back to Texas. And the other thing with this story I'll tell you, you didn't mention it, but I go to Oklahoma in this book, and Dave Whitlock and Emily Whitlock have been the kindest people to me from the first. They read Casting Forward before anybody got to read it, before it got published. And Dave did a blurb for the back of it. And Dave and I were supposed to be going fishing, and Dave passed away before it could happen. So Emily told me to come on up, and I went up there and stayed at their house for a few days. And we fished the waters that Dave and Emily fished, and I got Emily gave me one of his vests to wear. It still had his fly box in it with its notes. It was
Oh,
beautiful.
wow.
And so this book also ends talking about home, because beside that being his home waters and Emily's home waters, and these are two beautiful people and I love them both, I knew that the Devil's River, which is one of my core home waters here in Texas, was a place that they loved and they loved being together. So Emily asked me, would you take Dave, some of Dave's ashes down and put him back into the Devil's River for me? So in this book, I repatriate Dave's ashes into the Devil's River. That's how this book wraps up.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I help bring him to one of his homes, just like this may be my home, but I also feel at home in other places I've been. So that's why I go back to Texas, because every good change we can make starts at home, whether it's the way we're treating the clerk at the grocery store to the way we're treating our rivers. And that's why, I know I'm getting deep here, but that's the way I write. If you really love someone, you don't just use them up. If you really love something, you don't just use it. And I hear anglers saying all the time, oh, I love the river. I love being in nature. Well, good. Let's prove it. So
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
why I bring it back to Texas, because I'm watching this gorgeous place dry up. And I'm watching the hills be swallowed in roofs and McMansions, and the water be drained into golf courses and swimming pools and yards. So at some point with 8 billion people, we're going to have to start making some changes. And the point's now. And I know I sound like I'm preaching, but what I'm really doing is
No.
begging. I'm saying,
Yeah.
come on, come on, y'all. We love this place. We enjoy it. It's what keeps us going. We love going down that river. But would you want to go down the Snake River if there was no wildlife and no fish, just water? I don't think so.
Yeah.
In the book The
Now that's
Road, he gets to the ocean he's trying to get to find out that the entire ocean is dead. Well, it's not the same.
Yeah.
And we can fix this. And so, yeah, that's what I'm writing. That's why I bring it back to Texas. This is my home, and I want to do what I can for home while I'm trying to do what I can for everywhere else.
That's a
That's the deal.
great way to wrap up. Thank you for that, Steve. And but I got to ask you one more question, and it's the
Okay.
what's next question. Can you talk about what's next for you
I can,
in the
to a
way of
degree.
writing?
I
Okay.
can. Already under contract with Lions, just with a new series. I won't say the title of the series, but the book that I'm working on right now I'm going international with this, and I'm connecting us as I try to connect us across the United States, and now I'm connecting us to different parts of the world. And in this case, what I'm doing is this story is going to start with me on the very pinnacle of Portugal, where they used to believe it was the end of the earth or the end of the world, depending on how you translate the Portuguese. And I'm going to end up going the journey that the conquistadors took down through Mexico, Central America, the Amazon, and all the way down through Patagonia to what they then said, well, this must be the end of the world. And you can figure the symbolism here. And I'll be fishing in the Amazon with the native peoples there. I'll be in northern Patagonia and southern Patagonia, and I'll be going down the River Parana going after Golden Dorado. But you know, as you are gathering with my stories, there are a lot more than fishing that they're about. So I'm doing this all with the people that live there, love there. You know, I'll be eating their food, I'll be getting involved in their lives. So that's what I'm doing next. And I do know where the series goes, but I'm not going to say where the other books go. But this one is going to go throughout Latin America all the way down to almost to Tierra del Fuego. I don't know if I'll make it to there.
So
I'll get as
stay
close as I can
tuned,
to you,
folks.
Greg.
Yeah, stay tuned.
Thanks for asking.
More from Steve Ramirez. Yeah, looking forward to it, Steve. Looking forward. Yeah,
Me
yeah.
too. All I gotta do is stay living.
Well, we got to wrap it up here tonight. There's never enough time, but we got to quit sometime. We're already over time, so I want to get moving here to the end. But stick with me. We're going to give away 1 year membership to Fly Fishers International and 1 year membership to Trout Unlimited and a copy of your book, Casting Homeward, courtesy of Lions Press. So, folks, hang tight, and we'll be doing that in just a moment. The Bonefish and Tarpon Trust works very hard to safeguard the future of our beloved flats fisheries, from protecting spawning sites threatened by unsustainable fishing pressure to securing historic funding to restore Florida's Everglades and estuaries. Thanks to their members, they've expanded their conservation to the Bahamas, Belize, and Mexico. There's still much more work to be done, and they need your help. With your support, they can ensure that the flats fishery is healthy and sustainable now and for generations to come. Visit btt.org and become a member of the Bonefish and Tarpon Trust today. Again, that's btt.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, "What did you think of this show?" And just click on the link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. And now it's time to give away our prizes. Our winners for our drawings are randomly selected from a show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show. You don't want to miss a chance at winning some of these great prizes we give away. If you are one of the lucky winners, we'll contact you after the show, collect your information so that we can deliver your prizes to you. So the first thing we're giving away is a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International. To learn more about FFI, go to flyfishersinternational.org. And they are a great organization to support and covering all the bases with salt, warm, cold water fishing, you name it, and all over the world. Our winner for that is Anthony Lopez in Massachusetts. Anthony Lopez in Massachusetts. So congrats, Anthony, and thanks for playing tonight. I know you enjoy your membership. And we'll give away now a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. Again, a super organization to support. TU.org. To learn more about Trout Unlimited, go to TU.org. And our winner for that is Arthur Beans. Arthur Beans in New Hampshire. So congratulations, Arthur. I know you'll enjoy your membership as well. So now we'll give away a copy of Steve's latest book, Casting Homeward, courtesy of Lions Press. And to do that, I'm going to ask a question. And there is going to be on the homepage of our website, you'll find that, you know, the same place that you ask questions during the show, you can answer this question. So put in your correct answer, your name and location. First person that gets the correct answer wins Steve's latest book, Casting Homeward. So here we go. Let me clear my queue. And all right. So the question is, Steve talked about two fish that impressed him in Alaska. One should be pretty easy, the one or other maybe not so easy. I need the names of both those fish, okay? The two fish that impressed, or you could say that Steve got excited about when he was in Alaska. So let's have it, folks. Now, Steve, there's a slight delay before they actually hear the questions, and then they got to type their answers. So we got to kill some time here a little bit. But I think we had a great talk tonight, and a lot of important things we need to think about, you know. And a good time, you know, sometimes to think about it is when you're looking at that water out on the river and, and enjoying it. Yeah, and saying, hey, I'd like to keep what we got here. And, yeah, looks like we got a winner here. He's an Arctic grayling and chum. Yeah, chum salmon to be more specific. Are we going to take that as a winner?
That's Steve? A winner. That's okay, a winner.
That's Dave Goff in Thornton, Colorado. Dave, welcome to the fold here. And I know you sent in some questions about some kind of off topics, but we try to stay on topic. And but I appreciate you sending those in tonight. Dave, to get your prize, be sure to fill out that same form and send me your mailing address. I've got your email address. I've got your name. I just need your mailing address so that we can get Lions Press to send that out to you. So thanks for playing tonight. We've got some other winners. Phil McCartney had the correct answer. Bob, you know, Sockeye wasn't the one. Anyway, there were others, too, that had sent in correct answers. So thank you, everybody, for playing and paying attention and sticking with us to the end here tonight. We always appreciate your questions and your attendance, and love to have you on here. Steve, thank you again for being with us. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
My pleasure.
And, and to hear your thoughts on nature and fishing and the world. And always joyful. So hopefully again soon.
Thank you so much.
Sure. Hopefully you've all found the podcast archive on our website. If you haven't, just look in the link in the link in the top line of our menu on the website, and you'll find the archive and all of our past shows, over 400 and some shows now. You can search by keyword, keyword phrase. For instance, you could put in Steve Ramirez and find all his shows. You could put in Bill Horn and find out about the sockeye, you know, in Alaska, which I think would be good background for Bristol Bay. But anything else, Madison River tarpon trout, you name it, and you'll find something that will please and educate you, I'm sure. Our next broadcast will be on October 16th, and on that show I'll interview Alan Zaremba, and our show will be on Florida's exotic peacock bass. Alan has been fishing and guiding Florida waters since 1986. His expertise in catching the exotic peacock bass is unmatched. So join us as Alan unveils his top strategies for catching these colorful trophy fish. And whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, you won't want to miss this game-changing tips. So get ready to enhance your skills and land that catch of a lifetime, a peacock bass. Be sure to add this to your upcoming this upcoming show to your calendar. Right under Alan's photo on the homepage, it says Add to Calendar button. Just add it to your calendar, and then you won't miss our next live show. We'd like to thank Fly Fishers International, Trout Unlimited, Bonefish and Tarpon Trust, Lion's Press, Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics, and Ugly Bug Fly Shop, and Enrico Puglisi Flies for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.